Did I ever tell you about my my weekend with the late Roddy Piper?
No, please do.
This is when I was when I used to own a company called Live Audio Wrestling Incorporated. I used to do a radio show, uh-huh. internet property, and all that, and a bunch of websites for the pro wrestlers.
Now, but hold on, before you tell the story, can I make a prediction? Yes. Does it end with you two beating the shit out of each other and him trying to get you to put on a pair of glasses so you can see what the aliens really look like? No,
and I've all run out of nothing like that. I've run out of bubble gum.
Okay,
no. Okay, but he told me something really, so we had this like weekend where he came into town and we were looking to do a book deal with him and we had a meeting with a couple of different publishers and I don't know what, where Roddy was at in his life at that point, but sometimes he was together and sometimes he wasn't. But in the moments that he was really together, we were having dinner one night downtown Toronto and I asked him why in this world of pro wrestling where, and this is, you know, the Ultimate Warrior era where everybody hit the ring hard. Like you ran from the curtain to the ring, house on fire, big music, get the energy up, right? It's what everybody had to do. Piper
Ultimate
was
Warrior.
The one guy who came out from, yeah, that's it, right? Everyone came out from behind the curtain. So everyone came up behind the curtain and raced to the ring. Piper walked slowly and stared at everybody. I said, why did you do that? Why were, how come you weren't that guy? I mean, you were in the kilt and the whole, how come you didn't race to the ring? He goes, two reasons. One, he said he came from the territory days where your percentage, your payoff was based on a percentage of the house. And he said, I was really good at counting houses. So when I was walking down to the ring, I'd be looking at the house. And in my mind, I can count how much money is actually in the house. And I want my percentage of it in my envelope when I go back. So that's the one piece of brilliance. But then he dropped this one on me. And I thought about this, and this was so great. And this is like Marshall McLuhan stuff. Like, really understand the medium you're working in. He said, for live event, hit the ring, that's great. The crowd goes crazy. But this is a television era. And if I spend from the curtain to the ring 20 seconds to get there, that only allows an announcer to talk about me for 20 seconds. If I take my time, and I take 2 minutes to get to the ring, they have to fill the air with discussion about me for a full 2 minutes. By the time I hit the ring, I'm Superman. They've had to talk about me for a full 2 minutes. Everything that I've done, who I am, what my accomplishments are, why I'm so dangerous, all of it. And it was a really brilliant moment where I said, this is a guy that completely understands his environment. And right now we're in an environment with hockey where everything is fast, 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 go, 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 rah, 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 excitement. Look at how everything is cut together for promos, right? It's really quick clips and it's fast and it's big goals and it's slap shots and it's body checks and it's punches in the face. Everything is fast. The counter to that would be even that much more profound. All black, no music, walk out onto the ice.
It's funny because
Mike Tyson style from the old days.
And NWO style. Remember the NWO?
That too.
For entrances?
Sure.
Yeah. Very low, very deliberate. Slow delivery. Now, a couple of musical options here. Phil Coker says, I'm still waiting for the team awesome enough to hit the ice to the Undertaker steam music to tie it to wrestling. Karen Douglas says, how about walk right in and sit down? That's an old country tune, isn't it? I want to say. Maybe I'm wrong on that. And I would proffer this. I know that you're thinking more along the lines of arena rock, a Black Sabbath, if you will. How about Curtis Mayfield's classic theme from Superfly for
That's
teams
good.
To come out to?
But if I'm going to go Curtis Mayfield, you know what the one is? Right On for the Darkness. One of,
All
if
right.
not, maybe, that I'm glad whoever wrote that in is, thank you so much, because Curtis Mayfield is one of my favorite artists of all time, and Right On for the Darkness may just be my favorite song ever. That's the song. You know, every now and then when you like to imbibe in what we like to call in this business electric lettuce, and
you know,
it's really dark, I just want to have a little bit of electric lettuce and chill out and close your eyes and just let a song take you away.
Let's do
Ladies
it.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoy electric lettuce, I encourage you to do that to Curtis Mayfield's Right On for the Darkness. Oh, God, is it beautiful. I may do that tonight after the Nashville game is over now that I think about it. Thank you for that.
Electric Lettuce, by the way, also Merrick's nickname as a goal scorer.
Electric Lettuce. That's a great line.
All right. We got a lot of hockey to get to, including electric bracelets being tossed on the ice by Flyers fans.
Oh, God.
Also, a real life former NHLer coming on the show today, right?
Chris Mason, yeah, he's the color voice on radio for the Nashville Predators. Gotta get his thoughts on Thornton's beard. Gotta get his thoughts on Brent Burns' beard because, you know, Chris always had the dandy, and get his thoughts on Pekkarinen and the Nashville Predators and how they are doing this.
And we could probably also pick his mind on Mitch Korn, goaltending Yoda, who currently has turned Braden Holtby into the best goalie on this plane of existence. So we'll get to all that and some stuff that happened last night and the stuff that's going to happen tonight. A very weirdly timed podcast. It's a 4:30-ish start for us, which is almost to me like the West Coast version of the podcast. So like the people on the West Coast begin to get it at normal time, but we're starting it late. Which is very odd.
It's my schedule.
let's see if Sam is ready. If Sam's on is jet lagged at all for the beginning of the show, and let's start the show proper, shall we?
All right, here we go.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
It needs to be more psychedelia in hockey.
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
If I was going to trip out, I would want it to be pleasant. I would want it to be like watching an episode of My Little Pony.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
All right, listen, I can't believe I'm the only one who is completely obsessed with the fact that it was Ed Snyder night in Philadelphia last night. And it ended with Flyer fans littering the ice with projectiles. And it also ended with what I think is the perfect encapsulation of Philadelphia fandom, courtesy of, being born of two fathers, as they said in Platoon, Wayne Simmons, literally standing up before the fans saying, please don't throw these things. Effing stop throwing these things. And Ryan White after the game being like, yep, if I was in the crowd, I probably would have thrown one too.
Just sort of shrugged his shoulders. Yeah, whatever. I would have done the same thing. Next question.
Yeah.
Okay. I really enjoyed your piece this morning because I was thinking the same thing as this happened. I remember being a kid going to Exhibition Stadium, and once a year in mid-July, they would have something called Catelli Bat Day. And they would hand out bats at the baseball game. And you can imagine what happened when you mixed bats with alcohol and an emotionally charged ballpark. Violence, mayhem, chaos. You know, there's a reason they don't do these things in the Bronx. There's a reason they don't hand out violence. There's a reason they don't hand out glass bottles at hockey games, right? Where once upon a time they used to. It's certainly the East Coast thing they did, and the chicken wire stopped it when you wanted to throw it at the hockey players, but glass still got on the ice. My thought through all of this is, what were you thinking? What did you think was going to happen? You know, it's much like the rats. Let's hand out a bunch of rats in Sunrise, and oh, lo and behold, they've all hit the ice. Why would you want to, as an organization, put something in the hands of a hockey fan who, you know, in perhaps an inebriated state during an emotionally charged event that you have emotionally invested in and have not gotten the desired result you came to see, why would you expect anything other than what you saw last night?
There's a reason they started handing out the bats on Bat Day in the Bronx after the game. There's a reason for that. Like,
that's right. Don't
you handed out projectiles to a fan base that is legitimately known for throwing things on the ice and at opponents. And again, like, I'm sorry, Philly. I'm sorry that a few bad eggs spoiled the bunch and bad apples and spoiled the bushel and whatever. And I'm sorry that, again, it's the perpetual apology of having to say these aren't really our, this isn't what we do. These are just like few. I get it all. I understand. I'm a Devils fan. We have some rotten eggs too. The one thing I thought was real interesting today, though, was, you know, I got into an argument with several people, but I got into an argument with somebody who was trying to claim that the people who threw the stuff on the ice last night, threw the bracelets on the ice last night, weren't like real Flyer fans. And of course they are. Look,
oh my God.
Here's the definition of a diehard fan.
Stop. Just stop, people.
What?
This idea that, we've talked about this before.
I know.
This idea that hockey fans are beyond reproach. Those aren't real fans. The same thing as, oh, those aren't real fans that voted for John Scott. Those aren't real boat fans that voted for Bodie McBoatface. Okay, well, maybe that's a little bit different. But this idea that hockey fans don't really behave this way, yes, they do. We've seen
but
it
it's,
in
it's not even that. It's,
we've seen
it's,
it in
it's,
Vancouver, and we've seen it in Philadelphia. Stop.
And the Vancouver ones, the Vancouver ones, is the one that makes you mental. Like when you know the mayor of Vancouver comes out and says those aren't real Canucks fans, and there's a guy in a Trevor Linden jersey looting a store. Like yeah, that's
dude,
a real
I saw,
Canucks fan.
I was there. I saw a guy in a Christian Ehrhoff jersey kicking a window. Like you got to be a pretty sophisticated hockey anarchist to wear a Christian Ehrhoff jersey.
Yeah, and like you know a diehard fan is someone who is emotionally invested in their team to the point where the success or failure of that team affects their entire life. And who do you think's throwing a bracelet on the ice at or throwing a bracelet at Dmitry Orlov on the bench if they're not emotionally invested in what's going on here? It's not a bunch of anarchists that got shipped in from Camden, New Jersey, okay? It's diehard Flyers fans, and they're pissed off about what's happening. Just like it's diehard Devils fans who on a Tuesday night against the Calgary Flames are chanting, Rangers suck, Flyers swallow, Crosby watches. Those are season ticket holding New Jersey Devil fans who do that too. Really? I know. It's what happens at Devils games. So this idea that it isn't the most dedicated among us, the most psychotic among us, the most, and here's the operative phrase, fanatical among us that are doing these things is nonsense. It's nonsense that we're not the ones doing these things.
Yeah. Hockey fans do bad things. They do even worse things when they get alcohol. They do even worse things when they're pissed off and they have this thing in their hand. They don't care about it. Hey, looks like a Coldplay concert. I hate Coldplay. Now throw this on the ice. All right, great. You want to do it too? Sure. We got a minor penalty. Who cares? We're getting starched. Throw some more.
It just pisses me off so much that because of the actions of a few hundred fans in Game 3, the Flyers had to get rid of promotional sock full of coins night for Game 4. Which would have been amazing for those in attendance, because who doesn't need new socks?
And there goes Lawn Dart Night. I guess that's out, too, at the Wells Fargo. Fine. Thanks, Flyers, handful of Flyers
now,
fans.
On the ice last night in that game, I got to hand it to the Capitals, man. Like, we've been trying to find little harbingers of things to come for this team. This is a game they lose in previous seasons. They go into Philly. It's an emotional night. They get down 1-0. This is a game they lose in previous seasons, but they go in there, eye of the tiger, to put it in Philly terms, killer instinct, win game 3, and now even if Orpik can't go in 4, it looks like he can, even if Holtby gets shaken up in practice, and he was a little bit today, doesn't matter. Yeah. You have cleared the runway to potentially sweep a series in round 1, which helps you exponentially in your journey in the playoffs.
And with all the power play shooting options, that is freaking terrifying. Like, I know everyone's on Washington right now about how great they are, and I get it. They're fantastic. Right now they're doing what you expect the President's Trophy team to do, picking apart the Philadelphia Flyers. And they're doing it on the power play, much like the Detroit Red Wings. But the Red Wings said, you know, we don't need an enforcer. Our power play is our enforcer. That's Washington. That's Washington right now. You want to take liberties with us? That's cool. We're going to pump 5 power play goals on the man advantage past you. And that's going to be the ball game. And then it's over. And good for you. You took a run at us. Ooh, hope you feel good about yourselves. Take the L and go home. Oshie with that pivot in the middle. Ovechkin's one-timer is well told. And how about that shot from John Carlson? Well, was that a nice little play, too, at the top, just above the slot, where Ovechkin and Carlson switched and Carlson had the shot? It was like, oh, no, you take the shot. No, you take the shot. It's a very polite hockey moment between those two players.
Well, the Capitals are nothing if not polite. You know, they're a very polite team. Tom Wilson, always fighting with Queensbury rules, kissing the hand of others before he hits them. It's just a beautiful, polite team. Game of the night last night, though, without question, again, King Sharks are putting on a show for the ages already. We're only 3 games in, and it's one of my favorite playoff series in recent memory because of the personalities involved, because of the stakes involved. Last night, we get overtime hockey, and last night's what you expected out of Jonathan Quick in the first two games, which is a game in which he decides that his team's going to win, and lo and behold, they won. I don't think he can do it three more times. I think the Kings have to play better as a team, but God, boy, did they need that one last night, and they got it.
The power play at the end, when Kopitar doesn't have a stick, I'm like, uh-oh, this is over.
Oh,
this
and, is the, and they this are in finished. Cement. They can't move at that point.
Yeah. It was great. That's been such a fan. Like, that's the one where you say, whatever, like, I don't care about picks and stuff. Just make this, just have this go seven. Just give us
have it go seven,
seven of these.
Oh,
please,
yeah.
Please, have this go seven. A few things on that. Dustin Brown. The whole thing, like, you got to rewind. If you're going to go look at the game-winning goal by Pearson, you got to rewind at a certain point, because the whole thing starts with Dustin Brown hitting Donskoy. All right? Brown hits Donskoy. Dylan, who had already been popped by Brown before, goes after Brown, who's left open, Tanner Pearson. Now, we don't love the contract. Nobody loves the contract. But at that moment, was there anyone more important for the Los Angeles Kings than Dustin Brown?
That's the thing. I mean, that's the one thing I think that's kept him on that team, is the acknowledgement from Lombardi and the acknowledgement from Sutter, probably privately, but not in public, because he only says about five words every press conference, is that Brown brings that element, does little things, makes little plays in the postseason that other guys don't do. And it's very valuable to have that. Ain't valuable to the numbers of that contract, like you said, but very valuable indeed. I'll say, in defense of Dylan, having watched that play several times, I think he thinks the puck is still at Brown's feet. So he's coming over not only to give him a knock, but to pin him against the boards. He doesn't realize the puck already squirted by, and now all of a sudden Pearson has it. And then you get that combined with Couture looking to jump the zone, and then all of a sudden you got Pearson coming in alone on the wing, and it's a little baby two-on-one down low, and lo and behold, game-winning goal scored. I'm not exonerating Dylan. It's a bad decision, bad guess on his part. But that's what I like. I saw people that are like, "Oh, what a time to get bloodlust." I'm like, "No, it looked like he was just trying to hit him a little bit, pin him against the boards, make a play in the neutral zone." But a bad guess on his part is the point.
Yeah, our guess is there. One final thing on that. You do think, though, in the back of his mind, Dylan knows, I just got popped by Brown. I'm going to get me some as well. Chris Mason joins us. This is going to be a lot of fun. Former NHL goaltender. Now NHL analyst with the Nashville Predators on radio with our good friend Pete Weber. Chris, how are you today?
Doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me on here.
Pleasure is all ours. You were a man who, when he played in the NHL, took great pride in his beard. When you see Brent Burns, when you see Joe Thornton, what goes through the mind of Chris Mason?
Well, that's commitment, not only on their part, but by their families as well, because it takes a lot. Like I tell you, my wife didn't mind the beard, but once it got past a certain point, she's like, you know what? You can trim it up and make it look a little bit cleaner. So, they're awesome though. I love it. Brent Burns got the hair going too. So it's great.
Was there ever a part of Chris Mason though that said, oh man, I really, if I could do it all again, I would do it like Thornton and Burns. I would just let it say, honey, just give me the get-out-of-jail card here once, just for one season, just grow it that long.
You know what? Last year, I was in Germany, and I got the green light. I'm like, this is my last year, so I'm just going to let her go. So I let her go for most of the year, and that was the longest I ever got it. But, you know, beards have gained a lot of popularity here in the last few years, so everybody's growing them. And, you know, they're becoming more common, not just in playoffs, but just as a style in general. So it's all good. I respect the beard, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, Holtby grows a pretty decent beard over there in Washington, and you had a good one too. And I'm going to ask a very stupid question. Is there any effect of a big bushy beard inside of a goalie mask? Does it bother you at all?
No, I didn't wear a chin strap under there, so mine, it just had free rein, and it didn't bother me at all. Actually, you know, when I'd shave it, it felt weird because my mask would be closer to my face because it didn't have the cushion from the beard in there. So it served dual purposes, that thing.
That's outstanding. Okay, to the Nashville Predators. Here's the obvious question that I'm sure you've been asked plenty. How have they been able to do this? How did they take two games out of the Honda and come back to Nashville? How? Explain, Chris.
Well, quite honestly, obviously, almost everybody picked Anaheim, and I don't think, you know, Anaheim, I think they're a tough matchup for any single team in the Western Conference. They just have those big forwards. They have a very underrated D, two good goalies. But Nashville, I think, you know, over the course of the second half of the season, kind of figured out the balance of pushing the pace offensively, because they can skate. They have forwards that can get in there. They got guys that can put the puck in the net. And their D, their top four, I would put against any top four in the NHL, no question. Yeah. I mean, obviously, everybody knows Shea Weber and Roman Josi. Roman had a, you know, a huge breakout this year and entered superstardom and, you know, in discussion for the Norris Trophy and all that. But I think underrated pair in the NHL is no doubt Ryan Ellis and Matthias Ekholm. I'd almost put them against 80 or 90% of the league's 1-2 guys. They've been that good. And they've contributed on both ends of the ice, scoring goals and defending extremely well. And that is just, I think they've done just an outstanding job as a team defending Anaheim's big guys.
Pekka Rene, identical stats in the first two games. So 29 shots against, 27 saves, four wins in a row for him in total. And before that, in March, he had a five-game winning streak. What have you seen from him as far as kind of recapturing that Pekka Rene vibe we all like so much after what was a bit of an up and down sort of season for him?
Yeah, you know what? I think it helped with Carter Hutton playing so well down the stretch. He got in there and was able to give Pekka that rest where, in past seasons, they haven't been able to give him that. And, you know, the first part of the year, he wasn't playing bad. He was getting a hard time, and he's so hard on himself. But, you know, he had to adjust as a goaltender. You know, they weren't giving up the 35 shots. They were giving up 22, you know, 25 shots a game and under, and they were had possession for a lot of the game. And this is an adjustment for him. And any goaltender will tell you that that's not easy to do. So he dealt with that. He figured that out. And, combined with the rest, after the All-Star break, he was lights out and he won a lot of big games. And he's one of those guys, when he gets hot, he can stay that way. So it looks like that's where he's at right now. He's really confident, moving quickly, got a lot of energy, and you can just tell he's got a lot of swagger in his game right now.
Let's go back to that. That's an interesting comment, Chris, and we've talked about that a lot on the podcast, and we'll use the Pekka Rene example because it's the obvious one. Peter Laviolette takes over a little happier to exchange scoring chances, so shots are up for Pekka Rene. He's getting more of a feel for the puck. You know, he's getting a lot of shots, and he's getting into the game, and the save percentage reflects that. To your point, this year, they cut down on the shots on goal, so he's seeing longer stretches where he doesn't have activity, and his save percentage comes down, and it's not the same Pekka Rene. And we're saying to ourselves, okay, what happened to Pekka Rene here? My question to you is, as a goaltender, if you come in, say, midway through the first, starting goalie gets pumped for four really fast, he gets the hook, and you come on, is it wiser with a cold goaltender to shoot as often as possible at him, or to wait, be selective, and choose your shot carefully? What's tougher for a goalie to stop?
Well,
volume shooting or wait until a perfect shot?
That's a great question, because honestly, for a goalie, they tell you, you know, shoot the puck, get shots from everywhere, that's not necessarily the best way to score goals or to get a goaltender. If you wait, the teams that are hardest to play are the teams that don't just come into the zone and get the volume and just shoot the puck from everywhere. I mean, that can be an effective strategy. And obviously, if you have a team that's built like that and they're going to get to the net and, you know, make things tough from there. But as a goalie in general, if you're not getting the quantity and you're getting teams that are waiting, they're getting zone time, they're setting up, doing a cycle and making those, broken plays in the zone, that's harder for a goalie. The east-west, they're not just shooting for the sake of shooting and just trying to get to the net. They're waiting, they're picking their spots, and they're trying to find late guys coming into the zone. That's just a nightmare, especially for a guy coming in and even for the guys starting the game right off the bat.
What did you think of the goalie switch for Anaheim? I didn't think Gibson was necessarily at fault for the first two losses. Maybe this is one of those you got to try to change the vibe there going to Anderson. But what did you think of that goalie switch?
Yeah, I fully expected that to happen. I'm not surprised at that by one bit. And like you mentioned, I don't think Gibson played bad. He didn't let any bad goals. He just, in playoffs, he just wasn't able to be a difference maker. And I thought it was the right call. You know, Frederik Andersen's got a little more experience, and he's been there before in the playoffs. A couple years older. I think it's a good move, and they've had equally great seasons this year. So I think that's definitely what I would have done, and not a surprise.
Game three tonight, Nashville and Anaheim. Does Nashville rather play differently at home than they do on the road? Like, should we expect a different style of game out of Nashville tonight in the playoffs?
I don't think so. I think, you know, I felt they had real high energy. They're real composed. You know, Anaheim was trying to get them off their game, get them into the, you know, the after the whistle kind of stuff. And you know, for the most part, they stayed out of it and didn't let that affect them. I think the building's just, it's crazy for anyone who's been there. It's so loud. It's just going to be, especially coming up 2-0, it's just going to be nuts tonight. Mm-hmm. I think the way Peter Laviolette is, throughout this whole season, whether they're, you know, playing their best hockey of the year or playing their worst, he just so even-keeled. And I think that really rubs off on the guys. You know, they follow that lead and they embody his mentality and his calm demeanor, and they don't get too excited. You know, and they don't get too down when they're losing. And I think, especially in the playoffs, that's really going to help this team.
All right, moving over to Washington, where a couple of your old buddies there, Misters Trott and Mitch Korn, are working their magic. Tell us your adventures with Mitch Korn, goalie whisperer, goalie Yoda. I worked with him on my book a little bit. I worked with him a little bit and saw what he was able to do with Holtby. Is it any surprise to you that he's been able to mold and shape Holtby into the goalie that he is?
No, absolutely nothing. I had the pleasure of working with Mitch for 10 years over my career. I played in the minors for 4 years with him in Milwaukee, and then all my time at Nashville and everything. And he's a special coach, because a lot of coaches you will find after goalies spend time, they take on the coach's teaching. Francois Allaire was a big, butterfly style. He kind of revolutionized the position in that aspect, and a lot of his goalies look the same. But Mitch is a guy that he really individualizes his teaching. He breaks down exactly what your strengths are. He makes them better. He really works on your weaknesses and tries to limit them. And he just really tailors his teaching to each guy. And that's why they all look so different, starting with Dominic Hasek. And the list goes on with a number of guys he's had success with. And there's one thing to be able to play the position, but to be able to teach it and break it down and explain it is a completely different thing. And Mitch is, he's a master at that.
No denying it, he's been outstanding, and don't be surprised if, you know, a most obvious point of the day that Brayden Holtby ends up winning the Vezina. Last question for me, Chris. We'll let you get on with your day. You played in Prince George with Zdeno Chara, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one.
Yep, I sure did.
Okay. What was he like in PG, and who was the guy in Seattle he used to always fight? And did you see any of those?
Man, I'll tell you. Well, he was a great guy. It was his first year over in North America, and he was very humble and raw and just bright-eyed and obviously 6'9", so he was massive. But he came over there, and he didn't even have a winter coat. Like, they had to get him everything, and he had trouble. It was unbelievable the way he developed that year. First of all, the Western League is a tough league. Every single tough guy wanted to fight him. And the guy you're thinking of is probably Tony Mohegan.
Okay, he fought. Tony Mohegan.
But he fought the Scott Parker, Rob Skurlak, all the big guys. Every single guy wanted to fight him. And literally, the only guy that really gave him a run was Paul Ferrone, which, is funny enough, is a smaller guy in Seattle. He gave him a go, but the rest of the guys, they just couldn't get in on him. And he obviously, his balance got a lot better as the year went on. But it was just it was so fun to watch him develop, and then, you know, now you see him in his career and what he's turned into be. It's pretty cool.
Did you ever think for one second that guy could be this, you know, Stanley Cup champion, Norris contender, potentially future Hall of Famer?
Well, the funny thing was that when I saw him, his work ethic and how hard he worked in the gym, and that's kind of, you know, that's when training wasn't as important as front and center as it is today. It was kind of just, you know, getting into that phase where guys were getting strength programs and had special coaches to do that. So, you know, not a lot of guys in junior, we do kind of token workouts and get on the bike and stuff like that. But he was in the gym every day, and he was just working so hard, and he wanted to get better. And you just know when you see those guys when you grow up, they're just different than a lot of people, because, you know, they want to do the right things. Everything that they do has a purpose and practice. They want to get better. And he was like that when he first came over. And you could just see with his improvement how fast, how quickly he improved. And especially when he got to the pro level, it didn't take long. You know, he looked a little awkward at first, but man, he sure turned into a good player quick.
Last one for me, Chris. Now, you were in a charter member of the Winnipeg Jets 2.0, correct?
Yes.
What was that like? What was it like being up there in the return of that franchise to Winnipeg in year one?
It was one of the highlights of my career. I remember, you know, when the whole thing was going down and everybody, you know, the media was always looking to talk to players to get their view, and I was one of the only guys, I think, that, you know, wasn't very popular with the Atlanta fans, but said that I was hoping that the team would move there because I, you know, I grew up watching the Jets and I love the old Smythe division and all that. So when I got to witness what that was like for the people of Winnipeg and be part of that, and just like they were thanking the players, they're like, oh, thank you so much. And, you know, coming up to us, and we're just so happy you're back. It was just unbelievable. And then just the excitement at the MTS Center during the national anthem, all the games. It was I'll never forget that. And you know, throughout my career, that's definitely one of the highlights of my NHL career.
Still, some of the most creative fans in the NHL. Chris, busy night ahead for you. Thanks for taking time out for us today. Enjoy Game 3, and we'll catch up down the road.
Okay, anytime. Thank you for having me on.
There he is, Chris Mason, color analyst for the Nashville Predators on radio and former NHL goaltender. Yes, Greg.
How great was that? How great was Steve Mason? Chris Mason. I'm sorry, I was looking at Flyers thing. How great was Chris Mason?
Yeah, no. He's awesome. He's great. I've got to know him a little bit post-retirement. I talked to him a few times when he was playing, and it almost seemed as if, like, I watch a lot of Nashville regional games, and they would do this thing where they'd go down. This is, you know, I watch so many Pete Weber, Terry Crisp games. They would always go down to the bench, and you know, they put the headset on Chris Mason and talk to the backup goaltender. And I remember the first time I saw it, I said, "Uh-oh, if I'm an analyst in the NHL and I'm watching this, I'm thinking, oh great, here comes another one." Because you could tell that Mason, like, right away, yeah. A, understood the game, that's obvious, and B, could deliver. This guy's
goalies, even
every single game, like, he is just getting it.
Goalies in hockey are quarterbacks in football. It is a situation where they are the most cerebral and insightful people, and they always get the broadcasting jobs afterwards. Chris Mason.
How come they can't coach?
Because
goalies cannot coach.
Well, in hockey, obviously, goalies can't be coaches because I think it's there's such specialization in their position.
That's what I believe too.
Yeah, that it doesn't translate. It doesn't translate to everything else on the ice. In football, it might be the same thing. In football, it's very much like
I don't know it. Is it the same for quarterbacks? They can't coach either. Are there no football coaches that are ex quarterbacks?
That's a really good. I would love to find out that. In hockey, it's obvious why goalies don't make good coaches. And in football, you know, I'd have to really look into how many what the typical position that a coach played. I think there's probably a lot of linemen, I imagine. Ain't a lot of skill position players, a lot of linemen. And that could just be very much like guys who are used to, you know, running blocking schemes and stuff, understanding the nuance of that maybe a little bit better. And it's usually – the other thing about football too, and this might also be a thing about hockey too, it's usually some tough SOB that's the coach. It's usually some take-no-guff guy that's the coach, some physically intimidating guy that's going to, you know, put your ass in line and have you run those tires and hit that sled that's going to be able to do it. And that certainly isn't Dan Marino.
It used to be that in hockey. That's changing in hockey.
Right? It totally
is.
At
every single level in hockey. I wonder, is it changing in other sports as well? Like, you think of the physical sports, right? Like the contact sport. Is it changing in football? Or do you still get the crew guy screaming at you?
There's very few guys in the NFL that look like John Stevens, you know. It's like there ain't a lot of that in the NFL. So, right. Yeah, that's a real interesting question. Well, anybody who's a huge NFL fan, hit us on Twitter with the hashtag MVSW about why you don't think quarterbacks make good coaches. I think it's still the intimidation factor, and you need some drill sergeant in there to make it work. But that's a really good question. But they all make good broadcasters. I mean, you think about how many guys on the hockey side of things now are on TV.
Oh, God.
I mean, Mason,
all goalies.
Boucher, you got your Glenn Healy's, you got your all of it. Corey Hirsch's.
Kelly Rudy. Yep.
Kelly Rudy.
The next one. Keep
Go
going.
Back to right John Davidson list. Being, John Davidson being one of the best color commentators we've ever seen in this game.
Yep.
And so on and so forth.
John, you know why John was
able
to do that?
Of course, there's an Esposito also that does pretty good for himself, but not me.
You know why JD
The other one.
JD had so much clout and so many great connections. Like, on the hot stove, which, you know, for years and years was a staple on Hockey Night, on the hot stove, John was always great because John had the ability to pick up the phone and call general managers, coaches, whatever, and sell them on the idea that, you know, this is an important broadcast, it's crucial to the success of the NHL, and this is what this feature is, and we need something every single week. And could always sell them that, you know what, for the good of the game, I need something here. And John could deliver it in a really compelling way, and it was new information. And, like, honestly, he was, in a lot of ways, you know, that framework broadcaster for a lot of guys that followed. Like, don't ever disqualify this idea that this is why you want as many, you know, women playing hockey as well, because of the effect on young girls. Like, hey, I want to grow up to be, you know, like Hillary Knight. You look at a lot of hockey players, too, that towards the end of the career, they're thinking, okay, what am I going to do post-career? And I'm sure that plenty of them looked at John Davidson and said, wait a minute, I can do that? Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, really? I can be like that. I can talk on television. I can have these relationships. I can turn myself into that kind of professional in the next life. And I'm sure a lot of NHLers look at Kelly Rudy and do the exact same thing, or whomever.
Yeah.
Like, I think John really gets underappreciated as far as his effects, not just in the NHL, but on NHL broadcasting. I really do.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head as far as, you know, representation and how important that is. Because all it takes is one breakout, star analyst who happens to also be a woman to pave the way. And whether it's Hillary Knight or, you know, somebody on the Canadian national team maybe that makes the jump. You know, Jessica Mendoza is the best example, where she goes to ESPN. She does a bang-up job on Sunday Night Baseball. Now she's a star analyst for them. All it takes is one person to break through. All it takes is one person to get that seat at that table on Hockey Night and be treated with the import of any other analyst. And then the floodgates open. And I hope
I would throw Cassie Campbell Pascal into that studio on Hockey Night in Canada in a flash. As far as studio analyst goes, I would throw her in there in a second. I've told this story before here on the show. When I did Hockey Night in Canada Radio, the structure of the show was every day there was a different co-host who was one of the personalities on Hockey Night. Some days it was Craig Simpson, some days it was Kelly Rudy, some days it was Elliot Friedman, and every, I think it was Wednesday, it was Cassie. Nobody came more prepared, no one did their homework more, no one did it better, and no one delivered. This is with all due respect to all the guys that were on the show. Cassie was outstanding. And she did studio, I want to say, a couple of times for Hockey Night, but they've since then and before that only used her ringside, except for that one day that Harry Neal got snowed in Buffalo, and she got to work in the booth doing color with Bob Cole. But I'll throw Cassie into that mix for breaking down games and knowing the league and being prepared. Give me Cassie any day of the week.
Be awesome. Let's bang out some of these games here and catch up on some of these series. Last night, here's what I'm hoping this was for the Dallas Stars, because we're all rooting for them to go as far as they possibly can, so everybody plays that style of hockey. This hopefully was a bump in the road, a learning experience. You do have some rings in the room there, obviously, but you are dealing with a team that hasn't been through it too many times. They had a 2-0 lead in this game. That's a lead on the road you should not give up to a wild team that you're better than, that's also shorthanded. Bad loss, teachable moment for Lindy Ruff, and hopefully the Stars absorb this and come back stronger than ever in Game 4.
But at the same time, too, I mean, give it up for that Eric Howell line with Jason Pominville and Nino Niederreiter. They were outstanding, you know, last night. The only question now is what, you know, did Minnesota empty the tank and do they have anything left against the Dallas Stars? Because outside of, I mean, listen, it's tough to call an upset in any of the series because you can make a case for every single team. I'm talking about the Western Conference here. You can make a case for every single team. The only team you can't make a case for legitimately, like be honest here. Hey, Minnesota Wild fans, I'm talking to you. That you can make you, the only team you can't make a legitimate case for are the Minnesota Wild against the Dallas Stars. But having said that, there's a lot of inexperience on that Dallas Stars team. And the Achilles has been the blue line. The Achilles has been the blue line in their own zone. Mm-hmm. They were given free passes to the net yesterday. They were handed them out like Pez candies.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go. Right this way, sir. We've been expecting you to come
red
crash our crease.
Red carpet on the ice.
Oh,
yeah.
Red carpet.
Welcome
right, that. Right this way. Yeah, just, oh, yep, right this way. Just lift up the velvet rope there. Right this way, sir. Go right to the front of the net. They were doing that all night long. And that's probably going to stop if you know anything about Lindy Ruff.
Yeah. Tonight, you'll probably be here in this podcast after these games are done, but real quick, some loosey-goosey impressions. Tampa and Detroit, we talked about it. It's Detroit's defense that's going to be the difference in the series. If they have a prayer, we'll see how that whole thing goes. Unappreciated violence in this series between these two teams, too, isn't there?
Told you, man. Detroit hockey fans like blue-collar shiz, man. It's nice to score goals, and hey, we're hanging onto the puck. Look at our possession numbers. You know, give me a throwdown. No. Give me a punch. Yeah. Give me
Do your friends in Canada know that there's a violent Original Six team that plays close to the border in the playoffs? Like, why aren't you guys watching this series?
There's going to be attrition. I think everybody knew that going in with no home team to root for.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I didn't think they knew it was that much attrition, but it'll get better. Well. Like I said, like we've been saying on this podcast, like we can't talk too much about the ratings for obvious reasons. But Ovi said second round if it happens, forget about it. I mean, that's bonanza.
Giant. Yeah.
Giant.
Or will it just be a litmus test? We've always maintained that, you know, Canadians by and large are hockey fans and not just single market fans. Okay, we'll see.
Nah.
We'll see, because you could be handing him Sid and Ovi. Let's see what happens.
That's right. But we haven't had that. It's funny. Like, we talk about Sid and Ovi fatigue, but we haven't had it in the playoffs but once. And we all want it in the playoffs again, for sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of Sid, you know, it's funny. By the time you hear this, you'll know how the goaltending situation with the Penguins is shaken out tonight. But if Fleury can't answer the bell for the rest of the series, but Murray's healthy, I think they're all right. Because I think Murray's great.
Zatkoff looks like, wasn't he off the ice first this morning?
He was off the ice first, but Murray was in the starter's net. So they're kind of mixed messaging it a little bit.
And watch, Fleury will play.
No, he didn't practice. So I don't think he's going to play.
I don't trust anything anyone says in the playoffs ever. If Mike Sullivan's being honest, God bless him. If he's not being honest, God bless him. It's the playoffs. All bets are off. Assume that everyone is lying to you.
Nashville, Anaheim, we covered with Chris Mason.
Yeah.
St. Louis, Chicago, are the Blackhawks playing for their playoff lives in Game 4?
Nope. Nope, they're not. They could go down 3-1. You can still make the case for Chicago winning this thing. A couple of big goaltending performances away from winning it.
It's hold
tougher,
on. I'm...
But if, listen, man, like we've said, I don't know if you have. No, I think, did you pick St. Louis? Or did you take Chicago?
Shit, no, I picked Chicago.
You picked Chicago, okay.
Remember, I chastised everybody who picked St. Louis and San Jose. Called you all dummies.
Me. Well, I'm a dummy. I picked two. But listen, it's still plenty of hockey. I can still be proven a dummy. Trust me. I do it every day. I get enough airtime that, you know, if you listen to me long enough, you say, man, Merrick's full of it. He doesn't know what the hell. He doesn't know his ass from page six.
First of all, you're so flippin' nonchalant with your picks, no one remembers what the hell you picked. You're so blasé about your picks. They're just like, I don't know, it could go the other way. I'll just pick the Blue Hawks.
The real answer is, I don't know. I'll take the California Seals and the Pittsburgh Hornets. I don't give a shit. I don't know. I don't know who's going to win hockey games.
I'll take St. Chewis. No one knows what the hell you picked. I'm going to say this. I'll hit the alarm. I'm going to put the versus Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Right.
I think if Chicago loses game 4, they are toast. I think the Blues win this series if they win game 4. I think game four is the series. I think Chicago wins the series if they win game four. I think the Blues win the series if they win game four. Game four is the key to the whole thing. And we find out whoever wins game four, book it. Book your flight, book your hotel, the whole thing because they're winning the series. You're mark it down.
Giving up on Captain Sirius just like that. Giving up on Duncan.
I've not given up anything. Okay, because Captain Sirius and Patty Kane and all of your favorite dynastic stars on the Blackhawks could easily win game four. But if they lose game four, forget it. Book the tea times. It's over.
All right. Controversy.
Calling it.
Controversy from Greg Wyshynski. Oh, by the way, I want to mention something here. Because when things like this happen, we really should remark on them. Talked about offsides through history and how many great goals were really offside, this in light of the coach's challenge. And we have a screen capture from Dave R. at Soft Backcheck with a screen cap of the zone entry, 1970 May something, or 10th, I think. On the Bobby Orr goal, right? Sanderson to Orr. Noel Picard trips him up, and he scores a goal past Glenn Hall. It's a clean entry. It's onside. So scratch that one off the list of great goals that were actually offside. So the Bobby Orr goal from 1970. Thank you, Dave R. at Soft Backcheck. Got the screen cap. That zone entry was okay.
If I may request, Dave R., if you do get a chance...
Yep.
There's a goal that was scored in 2010. It's not an NHL goal, so I don't know what the official rules would have been in the IIHF at that point. But if you could check the legality of Sidney Crosby's goal.
Boo.
The Iggy over here, that goal?
Yeah, I have a feeling that's I have to imagine it was offside. I mean, I can't imagine anything but abject cheating.
Yeah,
resulting in that win. Yeah,
nothing to do with Ryan Miller feeding early on the poke check, exposing the five fold, and Crosby slided on the ice.
Okay,
that goal. He just slid it right on the ice.
Ryan Miller has his own cereal. He's an American hero. If you remember, it was his Olympic performance that also got him a Vezina trophy. So, I mean, I can't imagine it would be his fault. I have to imagine it was some sort of illegality at the blue line that was undetected at the time by the what I'm sure were Canadian officials.
Were we doing a podcast then?
We weren't. I don't think we were, were we?
I'd like to go back and hear how you talked about that goal. Talked about that game.
If I was doing the podcast at that point, it was probably with Pizzo, and I think the next the next few episodes would have just be me. It was just me sobbing.
That was like Sochi.
No, you know, I bring it up twice. Here and there, by the way. Oh, real quick on the Olympic thing. Did you see that story that I wrote yesterday or was kicking around where South Korea is importing a bunch of Canadian players they're naturalizing them as citizens so they can play on their Olympic team?
You're talking to the South Korean play-by-play voice right now, Jeff. Jeff Pack.
Jeff Pack!
Yes, I saw that. Not exactly a surprise.
I kind of love it. I kind of love that a lot, actually. I think it's great.
I love
the idea there being a collection. What a great, Cool Runnings movie that's going to be made from this at some point, where it's like a collection of Canadian, grade Z players that'll never get a sniff of the AHL, let alone the NHL, let alone the Olympics.
Guys,
I have the greatest idea. Let's become
South Koreans. Here's the deal.
guys, I got a great idea. Listen. Hold on.
Okay.
Right. Oh, yeah. Here's that's perfect. And then they walk into their local bar in Stouffville. And who's there? But it's Jim Pack. And they're like, and he's just slamming home whiskey, right?
It's Jim Pack and Richard Park sitting
right in
Richard
Park. And they're like, dude, oh man, we're like your biggest fans. We're huge Penguins fans. What are you doing in Stouffville? And they're like, dude, we just came from this development camp. We are so boned. Our South Korean Olympic team is gonna suck. And then they're like, dude, what if?
Hold on a second here.
Maybe we might be able to help each other.
What do you mean?
Think about this for a second. What if we all took the citizenship test and became, hold on, South Koreans?
So awesome. So fantastic.
Jim Pack stumbles off his stool. He's like, we don't even have a goalie. Does anyone in here play goal? I do. Are you South Korean? I could be.
I can. Can you find it on a map? No. Can you spell it? Yeah. All right, we got a goalie, guys. We got a goalie. All right, the blue line. Work on it. It's fantastic.
Hey, Jim. Yeah, Rich? Got a great news for you. Gretzky signed up. What? Yeah, Brent. Brent said he'd never get another shot at the show, but he's now South Korean.
That is a big chance. You know, the Jamaican ice hockey team continues to practice as well. I got to find out who's on, who's with this squad. I know Graham Townsend's one of the coaches.
Oh, God.
That would be a cool team to play on.
It's good times.
Yeah, it's great. And listen, man, hockey's great. Hockey keeps getting better. Hockey keeps getting more fun. Mm-hmm. I know we all grouch, man, this sucks. Hockey's fun, man. Guys, don't forget. Gals, don't forget. Hockey's fun. It's okay to laugh about it. And when it starts to get too serious and take itself too seriously, don't be shy about taking the piss out of it. It's okay.
Damn right. That is pretty much, I think that was my cover letter for Puck Daddy. thanks for joining us here on the podcast, late afternoon edition. Thanks to Sam. Big thanks to Chris Mason. Dial him up on the radio, raise radio side, right?
Radio side with Pete. Yeah. Weber.
Dial him up on the radio side with Pete, our good friend Pete Weber, and hear you some great analysis. That was good, good thoughts on everything, and in all things, including that goalies like to have beards because it creates a little cushion for their mask.
Like you so wouldn't do that. I would do that. Oh. It's funny too because to get all goofy Society of Hockey Research, Jeffy, goaltenders used to take hot showers and shave right before games. You know why, Greg Wyshynski? Because if you had stubble, it hurt more when you got stitches. So they wanted their faces as clean shaven as possible before they got stitched up from getting pucks and sticks
in
the face.
Stitches that'll get you.
That's right. Now they're all growing frickin' beards because it feels awesome. So nice and tidy underneath that mask.
Well, thanks to C. Mace and thanks to everyone else for listening as per usual. Back in effect in due time, and we'll figure it out. And there it is. Enjoy the hockey tonight. Come by Puck Daddy. I'm on the stick tonight and say hi. And you guys are the greatest.
That's right.
Talk to you soon.
Hockey's
everybody. When this podcast becomes the official podcast of the South Korean Olympic team,
we are.
Follow us over.
We are available. Any South Korean entrepreneurs.
One last thing too, like as much as I crowed about how awesome it was that a lot of yous that listened to the Wednesday thing with Lozo, the Puck Soup thing, made it the number one podcast on iTunes, which of course is all bullshit metrics and stuff like that.
No, it's good.
You guys also made our triumphant return after a week off in the top 15 episodes yesterday on iTunes, which is really cool because the stuff in front of us is like all 3 hours of Dan Patrick and all 2 hours of, like, it's all just like the same show. So literally, if you combine all of the episodes that are the same show, it puts us in the top 10 for episodes, which ain't bad for a hockey show. And thanks again for that. We really do appreciate it. Even if the American iTunes numbers, don't really mean anything in the grand scheme, as we've come to find out. Sorry,
To quote Ryan White, whatever.
Oh, yeah, and to quote Greg Wyshynski, I'm going to dip my head in a vat of acid now. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.